In the house of the live stream chat as well. He says, let's go. Well, we're going to go. We're going to have a great show today because Patrick Rohrman from MT Knives, who is also a member of the expert council, is going to be on with us in just a minute. And the first two of these interviews just kind of happened. Ken Daniels started it out and Patrick had just put his app in right behind his. But I'm actually including this in a new series we're doing called Meet Your Expert Council. And I am trying to bring people on that have not yet been on full episodes that are expert counsel. So we'll be reaching out to people like Ryan Steva and Carrie and some other folks like that first. But we're going to get everybody on in the next few months to make sure that we get enough questions so these guys can give us enough content. The more you know about them, the more you realize what they can do for you. What we're going to be talking about today is knife skills for self-sufficiency with somebody that knows a little bit about that. I don't know. Maybe I should send this over to Patrick and get him to tighten the edge up on it, and I won't even tell you what it is unless you're in the video. If you're in the audio, you have to come take a look at 1 minute and 10 seconds in to see what we're talking about today. But anyway, Patrick knows a little bit about blades and making them beyond razor sharp, picking out the right pattern, and understanding all of the things that knives enable in our lives from a self-sufficiency standpoint. We will bring him on in just a minute. Before we do, let's talk about something that's not knives, but it's definitely important technology. That's Start9 private servers. You know, you hear this thing about the cloud, right? The cloud, that's where our data is in the cloud. There's no cloud. The cloud is bullshit. It's a lie. It doesn't exist. It's not real. It's just somebody else's computer, which means that somebody else controls it. Somebody else can, like, steal your data, be a breach of your data, lock you out of your data, just delete your data, whatever it is, because you displeased the crown or what have you. With Start9, you can make all of that go away. You can access your data fully encrypted from anywhere in the world over Tor. They call it the dark web. It just means they don't like you using it. There's nothing to be afraid of with it. It just makes you safe, secure, and private. You can also run a Bitcoin node. You can run a Bitcoin Lightning node. You can literally be your own merchant account provider with Start9, and it's not that hard. If you can use a phone and install apps and use apps, you can run a Start9 server, and if you need some help, they'll be happy to give it to you. Check them out today at start9.com. Next up, the sponsor, I'm not sure. There's kind of a competition here between, ironically, KnifeKits.com and the Berkey guy. Who's the oldest survival podcast sponsor? That goes so far back, I can't really remember. But the Jeff the Berkey guy, Gleason, has been with us since at least March of 2009. That's a long, dadgone time in the world of podcasting, and you can learn more at USA Berkey Filters about what Jeff has for you. Mostly, of course, it's Berkey filters and Berkey filtration systems. Everything's back in stock and ready to go, so check it out today at usaberkeyfilters.com. With that, let's bring our special guest on, Patrick Rohrman from MT Knives. Patrick, what's up, man?
Hey, man, I'm doing great. Just, living the dream.
Yeah, you know, I said we're going to bring people on from Expert Council that haven't been on the show for full episodes. But other than Expert Council, it's been a long dadgone time since we've had you on the air with us. I don't think we've ever had you on for a video. So that's going back about 4 years now that we've been doing this as a video podcast as well as audio. So it's been a while.
Yeah, man. Like last time I was, on a podcast was my wife and I were in your living room in Arkansas, right?
If it's really that long, that is a long time ago. That's like 2011.
Yeah.
That might be right. I've not had you on. Well, you know, there's this thing called the guest form. And when you fill it out, then you get to be on the show, you know?
Yes, sir.
But let's start off with, you know, how did you even get into this world of making knives? I mean, I know that story. Some of the real old OGs know that story. But let's go back before you had ever made a knife and how you end up making this one of your passions in life.
Yeah, I kind of want to just retell my story for all the people who haven't heard it. And, you know, for you who have, you know, hopefully maybe you'll glean some new stuff. But, you know, back when I was a kid, there was these Ginsu knives. You know Ginsu knives, don't you, Jack?
Yeah.
It was the infomercial of infomercials. You could saw through a brick and cut a tomato like butter. And, you know, just, I mean, it's all things. You know, a young boy, you know, we grew up Transformers and, you know, what other Thundercats and, you know, all the things, you know, swords, knives, all that cool stuff. And one of my core memories I have was I was probably, you know, early teens, and my dad was a hunting and fishing guide. And he pulled out his knife. My dad could never go fishing without watching the weather first. And really, now I kind of know what it was. He was just waking up, dealing with, you know, having his coffee, having a cigarette, and getting ready to put up with me, probably. But he sharpened his knife, and he went and he just shaved the hair. Just the hair started popping off his arm. And, you know, I was just amazed. And the funny thing about that is that's the only time I really remember my dad sharpening a knife. He was a hunting and fishing guide. And, you know, it's just kind of funny how those memories we pick kind of stick out. And years later, it's almost like he forgot the skill. He would use all those stupid pull-through sharpeners or, you know, just whatever. It's like, what happened to the dad that I remember sitting on the couch and pulling out a whetstone and, you know, sharpening that knife, hair popping sharp. So really my knife fascination started just with having a knife as a tool, right? And a tool, all tools give you power to do things that you couldn't otherwise do or would be hard to do. And, you know, kind of when I first found your podcast, I was all into learning bushcraft and survival skills back before all the TV shows and YouTube was still pretty new. And I was watching bushcrafting type stuff and learning about the 5 C's. And one of the 5 C's is a cutting tool. And if you were to have to survive, it's a very valuable tool to have, to process game, to build shelter, to do all the things that you need to do that require a cutting edge. And so I don't really know where that passion started, but, you know, those were just some of my core memories as a child, wanting to wield a sharp blade. Well, I can't hear you, Jack. Maybe you're muted.
Yeah. And what I was saying is that, it is one of those things, like when we look at like Canterbury's 5 C's, the cutting tool is one of the most difficult to create for yourself if you don't already have it. Cordage isn't that hard to make. A container isn't that hard to make. Cover is not that hard to make if you have the cutting tool.
Yeah.
Right. It's one of those key things. Like, you can make some pretty sharp shit out of some obsidian if you find it, right? Like, it is one of those things that you really want to have a good quality tool like that if you're going to be involved in any kind of bushcrafting or day to day. I'm amazed by how many people ask me something like, do you carry a knife like I'm carrying an Uzi strapped to my back or something? And then, you know, constantly that same person back when I was in an office environment would come up, hey, can I use your knife? Hey, can I use your knife? Hey, can I use your knife? It's kind of crazy. I mean, you did a segment on it not too long ago about like knife bias. Like, people act like this knife is like that thing that I just showed everybody during the intro. And like, you're walking around with it on your back and it's just a pocket knife. And I've always been amazed by that. I think the first time somebody handed me a knife and just said, go have fun with it, it was like my grandfather. I was like 6 years old. You know, I don't really understand this complete and total fear of the basic tool of humanity.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is people are afraid of knives because they think they're weapons. Well, the more skills you have, the less tools that you need. And the fact of the matter is there's weapons all around. I was at an event one time and, you know, one of the coordinators of the event was like, hey, we're going to have metal detectors, so you might leave your knives at home. And it's like, well, is this a courtesy thing? Or like, are you worried about bringing a knife or what?
Yeah.
So I'm like sitting at this table and I'm like, you know, it's just retarded because I'm looking at an easel right over there.
Yeah.
I can snap a leg off the easel and stab somebody with it.
Yeah.
And sometimes you shouldn't say stuff like that because it happens.
There's so much you can do with things that no one finds innocuous. I was listening to this comedian, and they're like, you know, you can buy bike locks on Amazon. So I'm like one Amazon order from closing half the business down just by walking by and slapping bike locks on their doors. Or you can buy those orange cones. I can lead traffic anywhere that I want it to go. It's kind of a funny thing when you think about how many things out there are quote unquote dangerous, but we've decided to focus on these. I guess if you're in London, knives are pretty dangerous, but in America, you know, like it really isn't the biggest thing I worry.
Well, California, you know,
yeah.
I think they might even cause cancer in California.
I'm sure that your knives really are supposed to have the Prop 26 or whatever it is warning, because between Kydex, parachute cord, and whatever, there's got to be something in there that trips that warning. But what made you decide, like, hey, I'm not just going to, like, have this as the thing that I mess around with. I'm going to make a business. I'm going to build a company and make it a full-time passion-based business.
Yeah, so I guess the idea, you know, like, it got to a point in time where, well, for one, I started down the sharpening path, and I started learning more and getting better. And I ended up flying to Oregon and learning from a 17th generation Yoshimoto bladesmith. And, I spent a week in Oregon. I learned how to make three knives, and a guy by the name of Murray Carter, which is kind of funny. He was a Canadian who went to Japan, who basically earned the title from a bladesmith that didn't have a son, and okay. then came to America to teach people how to make knives. And I was one of his first students here in America. So that was, it was a trip of a lifetime, you know, like, it was a very expensive class. And for somebody with, I don't know, let's see, we would have had five kids at the time. So tell my wife, hey, I'm going to take our tax return, fly out to Oregon and learn how to make some knives, and maybe I'll make a business of it. Which I learned a lot of things, you know, with business over the years. Number one, if you're going to go spend a lot of money and learn a skill, start a business first. That's a tax deduction.
Yeah. You could have used your tax return and turned it into next year's tax deduction, but you didn't have the business.
Yeah, but... So, yeah, that's kind of how I got started. And then the beautiful thing about it was, is this was before a lot of censoring on the internet. And I was like, you know, this is a product that I can make and I can sell basically anywhere in the world, save, you know, places you're not legally supposed to ship to. And it's a, you know, it's a small product that you can make and ship anywhere. So my customer base, you know, like, the old thing in real estate, right? Location, location, location. The reason location is so important is because of traffic and eyeballs. Yep. Well, the internet is that prime location that people paid hundreds of thousands of dollars or millions of dollars for in the past. We have it free, you know, basically free. And so thankfully I was able to capitalize on that, started making knives, found this hippie duck farmer dude on some podcast thing. And listen to him rattle in my ear while I was at work. And, you know, so I reached out to you and made you that mammoth test knife. And that was history, right?
Yeah, yeah. And you ended up with the stakeholder program. And that was something that I think, again, the OGs might know, but there's probably a lot of people don't even know that that's a thing, right? Now, when you went to go full time with this business, we partnered on that, and it went so well, it broke your website.
Yes. Yeah, that was, you know, that's still something to this day that I think it really was amazing on so many levels. Like, the crazy part about it all, too, is I'd put in my notice before the launch. So I was committed. Like, I was already all in. And I kept having those thoughts of, like, what am I going to do if only 30 positions sell? Or, you know, like, and the crazy thing about it was, is I would not look back and tell somebody to do what I did, because honestly, Charles is in the house. Jack used to have a podcast called 5 Minutes with Jack, The Road to 100K. And, you know, I listened to that, and Murray Carter had paid tens of thousands of dollars for a business course. And when I listened to 5 Minutes with Jack, I could see how he had implemented everything that you said, and he implemented it because he paid that high cost for it.
Yep.
And so he was vested in making sure to get that return. And Charles, you know, he played like a game of chess strategically and strategically positioned himself to where when he left his job, you know, he might have other, you know, he did it smart. I kind of fly by the seat of my pants, just, don't prepare as well as I should, and just hope things work out. I'm a little more reckless that way.
Yeah. We've seen some recklessness from you, and it's always been fun, too. Let's get back to the knife topic. Why are they such essential tools for homesteaders, survivalists, outdoorsmen, honestly, just any?
We use knives every day. Like, people do not realize how often they're using a knife, because a lot of times, knives are a good knife is designed for one task, one purpose. And so it's implemented. You got a roll of tape. It's got a knife on it, right?
Yeah.
Like a tape dispenser. We have scissors. We have all these are just forms of knives, axes, machetes, like your printer, if your label printer. You know, yeah. I mean, yeah. We have to cut stuff every single day. And the question is what knife are we going to use for that purpose? Box knives, and the problem is too, is so many people use a box knife or they use the wrong knife for the wrong purpose. Yeah. That's a
that's a knife.
You call that a knife? I actually,
it's by the way, it is real.
We're showing off knives.
It does not have a Patrick edge on it, but it has an edge on it that it intimidates me a little bit. I'll put it that way.
Well, if the knife's large enough.
Yeah. I was going to say there's a weight transfer thing going on there.
It's like if you shoot someone like a 50 cal and it's like, well, should we make it a little more pointy?
It doesn't really matter, does it?
It doesn't matter.
But I get what you're saying. Like almost every day, we're using some form of cutting implement in our lives.
I mean,
some of us actually shave, but
I didn't shave, but I use some clippers, another form of knives. And in an agrarian lifestyle, I mean, we have knives that cut the ground, we have knives that cut the weeds, we have knives that cut the crops. Sickle. Our farmhand when I was growing up. Jack, do you remember the sickle mowers?
Yeah.
He grabbed the sickle and was going to lower it down.
Okay.
But he had his fingers in between the sickles.
Ew.
He just about took off all of his fingers.
You won't do it.
Yeah.
Those blade.
Yeah. I mean, the thing people don't even think about, too, is something like a hoe or a shovel. They're essentially a cutting instrument. The old timers would always sharpen their hoes. They would sharpen their shovels. A shovel, if you're digging in rocky terrain, it's not going to take a whole lot to lose that edge, but it makes a world of difference. And so learning how to sharpen, what angles to sharpen, even a cold chisel, you sharpen to cut metal.
Absolutely. So
it's all about learning edge geometry, how to make that cutting tool cut whatever you're cutting in the most efficient way possible. And so this is a lot of people would think that maybe I know everything about sharpening. I don't. I've been sharpening. I just spent some time on the phone this morning with another sharpener asking him questions about this or that. And really, in some ways, it's kind of pointless because at some point there's functional sharp and then there's just showing off sharp. But I want to be an expert. I want to be the world's best sharpener. And, is it pride? Is it? I don't know. I don't know what drives me, but I guess what I'm passionate about is learning how to sharpen, how to properly sharpen. All about the proper edge geometries. I want to know what is physically possible. And so the only way you're going to know is by tons of research, tons of studying, tons of practice. And the crazy thing about the internet today is there's so many people. When I started this journey years ago, it was easy to stand out because if you could get a knife to shave, most people were impressed. Now, it'd be interesting to have the data just to know how many people can sharpen a knife today versus 10 years ago. And I'd say the number's got to be 4x, 5x.
And I would say that probably YouTube and TikTok and sites like that have the biggest effect on it. Like one thing, we give Gen Z a hard time, but one thing they've become pretty good at once they get to the point where they have to do shit because people won't do it for them anymore is going to YouTube and all these other sites and figuring out how to do things through like YouTube University. I will say on your sharpness, like you make, this is one of your talents, which is, this is my favorite little neck knife in the world. And you're the only knife maker I know that wraps your knife in a warning label and includes a pack of Steri-Strip with your knife. And I did see somebody almost cut his thumb completely in half with the slightly larger version of this at one of my workshops. When Patrick tells you a knife is sharp, he means it. It's like, I remember a long time ago, one of my favorite one-liners you ever uttered was, if you didn't want something cut with it, you shouldn't have touched it with it. And there's a lot of people that sharpen knives that when they say that, they would be bragging and bullshitting a little bit. when Patrick tells you that, he's not bullshitting. He actually sharpened a cleaver for a mutual friend, like a giant Dexter cleaver. And that guy just hands it to guests at his house because he knows it's so heavy that as soon as they touch it, they're going to cut themselves with it. You know, people in this audience either know who that is or it doesn't matter that I give out his name.
Yeah, I was that was a crazy. He said, sharpen it so sharp that it's that whoever touches it will cut themselves. Well, sure enough, I finished up sharpening it and I did something and it just it bit me. And I was like, well, there you go. It's gonna cut whoever touches it.
Yeah, there is a history of us making you cut yourself at my workshops. We used the giant, I can't remember the name, what it was called, something cutlery corner knife, the bonus giant cutlery corner knife. I gave you that. You tried to throw it and you cut yourself. You cut yourself on the cleaver that you sharpened for David that we're talking about. I gave you my karambit and saw you start flipping around. I'm like, well, let me go get you the trainer. And I didn't even get distracted. I went straight to my room, got the trainer, and brought it back, and you already had blood soaking through a paper. So one of the benefits of buying a knife from Patrick is it might have some blood on it, and you can then clone your own Rorman with it. Like, that's one of the benefits there. But we're kidding, but I'm serious. Like, but my belief is, now, you can cut yourself a lot deeper with a knife like this. But in the end, most people tend to cut themselves with knives that are not sharp enough. And that leads to frustration and doing things you shouldn't do. And that leads to, like, really whacking yourself good.
Yeah, dull knives. Whenever I see somebody really putting some pressure into knives, it's like, stop. Like, you probably have the wrong tool. Or, you know, the whole saying, I think everybody should be taught, don't cut towards yourself.
Yeah.
And the thing is I do it, but anymore, like if I have a sharp knife and I'm cutting towards myself, that little voice in my head's like, don't be stupid. Because you always think like, I'm not going to slip until you slip. And then you're like, that was deep. That was good.
You know, there, Jeff Lawton had this idea for a book that was like 1,200 things that every child should learn before they're 18. You know, one was like water moves at right angle to contour because that has so much to do with earthworks and permaculture. But it was beyond permaculture, and I think that would be one of my nominations for one of the things in that book. Don't cut towards yourself. When I was in shop class, my woodshop teacher used to refer to it as the plane of hazard. Like when you are using a radial arm saw, like you don't belong behind it. You belong to the side of it. And that, I mean, I learned that when I was 14 years old and I'm 53 now, I guess. And that's still in my head. Stay out of the plane of hazard.
Well, I bet you that guy wish he would have known that when he was shooting that lawnmower with Tannerite underneath of it.
We have a question here about your website, so I'm going to bring it up on the screen for people right now. MTKnives.net is the website, and if you go there and you click on store, you can see all of the production knives anyway, semi-customs, I guess, that are available. And this little guy right here, the Talon, it's a little bit smaller than the Genesis, and it's this knife right here. I love this knife. I love everything about it, except the two that you sent me didn't come wrapped. And I got to wrap my own damn handles like a pauper. But no, seriously, like I really was never a neck knife person until I met Patrick. And it was because I had bought several neck knives that had poor quality sheath. And I bought one from Cold Steel one time, just a cheap one. Actually, I think I bought a couple knives from Cold Steel. And they knew who I was. And they sent me a whole bunch of shit. And one of them was in there. And I'm like, well, I'll try this. And I was driving in my truck down that bumpy ass road I used to live on in Arkansas. I got to my office, and as I went to stand up, I could feel something pushing on my stomach. And that knife had fallen out of the sheath and was inside my shirt with a heavy jacket over it laying against my stomach. And I went, screw some neck knives. That was the end of neck knives for me till I met you. And you're like, you do know you can put them in a sheath where they won't do that, right? And you made me that first knife, which was also a neck knife. And I've been sold ever since. But what I really like with your Genesis and your Talon is this very thin profile that lays flat to the chest. And It's one of those things that's everywhere whenever you need it. And I really encourage people not to turn this into an empty knives infomercial, but definitely consider getting one of these or its bigger brother as at least one of your EDC blades, because there's a utility there that I think is hard to understand until you experience.
And I'm currently, we've redesigned the Genesis sheath, and I have some that soon there'll be a belt attachment or some other kind of attachment in case you don't want to carry it as a neck knife. I personally I encourage people to try a neck knife. Give it a fair shot, because it's just hard to beat the convenience of having it right there. You know, even honestly, you know, when you're talking about carrying anything like a firearm, a lot of those chest mounted rigs, the thing about it being at your chest is it's accessible, and it's not going to be blocked when you're sitting in a chair.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, there's lots of times that if something's in your pocket or on your side, you can't get to it. Not to mention it is more available for people around you. When something's at your chest level, like, somebody's got to get inside of your zone to access it. So it's just a lot more accessible, a lot more secure. And, you know, the nice thing is it conceals easy. I know in some place that's not against, it's against the law. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to tell you what to do, what not to do. But also, I've always had the kind of understanding of, I'm not worried about what's against the law sometimes. If it's a life or death situation, you know, what's that saying? I'd rather be tried by 12 than carried by 6, or.
Absolutely.
So now the other thing is too, is I don't make weapons. Genesis is an ultra light EDC knife. It's made for everyday use. It's a high hardness. I would not want to use it for self-defense, but hey, I ain't against using my teeth or my, you know, whatever. Self-defense, all's fair in love and war, they say. You know, when it comes to self-defense, you use whatever tools that you need to keep yourself safe, your loved ones safe.
I did use one of your knives for defense one time, but it wasn't against a human. It was against a zombie raccoon.
Oh, yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, I was in boxer shorts, too. I shot a raccoon off our porch, and I didn't want it laying at the bottom of the deck overnight and stinking and the dogs going out and messing with it. So I went out to get it and throw it over the bank the hell away from the house. And I was wearing flip flops, boxer shorts and no shirt, but I had my Patrick knife on, and I ended up in this kind of ravine down at the bottom of our deck, and it was just clay and wet and slippery. And just as I went to pick that thing up, it stood up like that scene in Elf, and it was angry. It was pissed off with a bullet in its head. And I stabbed it to death because I had no means of retreat. When a raccoon stands up on a normal sized man, their head is exactly the height of about a part of your body that you really don't want messed with. And so it did work. But yeah, I would agree it wasn't optimum tool. It was also that mammoth knife. So it had more of a sheep's foot pattern designed not to stab.
Oh, yeah.
When you need to, you can. I'll just say it. You can do it.
Slashing tool.
No, I had to get inside. I had to kill. I mean, it was killer be losing beans, man.
That was a time where I wish you had like one of those Nest security cameras. We could see the footage on.
Yeah, that would have been a good one. I don't think that I probably would have had a camera down in that ravine, but it would have been cool to have videoed. I should have been not stupid and took the rifle with me. That was the smart thing to do. But on that note, the only reason I picked that up is that that was not the right tool for the job, right? So can we talk about some of the most important factors to consider when you're choosing a knife for, like, everyday use, patterns and what have you? That's part of why I like these little knives, is they're great for that everyday use.
Yeah, you know, everybody's got a different level of what they want to carry and what they, you know, what jobs they're going to be doing with a knife. The Genesis, I feel like, is a perfect size EDC knife for most people. Currently, I'm working on all these bird and trout knife profile for my stakeholders, and there'll be some other non-limited edition knives of that profile too available hopefully this year. Here's the thing, for a knife, you want it as absolutely thin as possible to do whatever task that you're going to do with it. The thinner the knife is, the better it's going to cut. If we could get away with just having a sheet of steel that was, you know, half a micron thick to do our slicing, then that would cut through just about anything. But we make a knife thick to give it more strength to cover pressures, side pressures, cutting things, just to make it more rigid. But for a good cutting edge, the reason we cut string with a wire is because some things that you cut are going to have a lot of drag. And so we're trying to reduce drag, and the thinner the knife is, the less drag it's going to have. You can get creative with your grind. You know, there's S grinds and all different types of grinds that we put on knives to help them perform better. But really, as a maker, I need to know what you're going to be cutting,
mm-hmm.
how you're going to use it. You know, like, there are some people, and I won't name no names because I don't want to do that to people. There are some people that I put a lot steeper, tougher edges on their knives, but because it doesn't matter what you do, they're going to use it for, they're going to use it like a farmer. They're going to be out there scraping grease off of engine blocks and who knows with it. But so I want to know when I'm making a knife for somebody, I want to know what they're going to use it for. I want to pick the proper steel, get the good edge geometry for whatever task they're doing. And I'm going to make it as thin and as sharp as I possibly can. That's going to last for them because I can make a knife crazy thin, crazy sharp. The question is are you going to break it? Are you going to bend mm-hmm. it? Are you going to roll that edge? And if you are,
janky might.
Yeah. I wasn't going to throw him under the bus just yet.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm the other one he's talking about though. I'll own it. I'm pretty hard on tools and equipment. And it is important that you look at the use and then the person who's going to be using that knife, because there are people that will, they'll baby a knife beyond what needs to happen. There's people that will push it beyond what it's really intended to do. It all depends on who you're making it for. But the profile's a big deal. I mean, if I go in my kitchen, all of my knives, whether they're something you made or they're like a shun or something like that, they're very thin profile knives. Well, because they're kitchen knives. Yeah. Like, you really shouldn't, I'm not going to say, I was going to say you wouldn't, but there's always somebody who will, but normal people wouldn't take a kitchen knife out and start like making notches and stakes you're going to put in your garden and build a trellis out of. They're not for that purpose, but they do what they do really, really well, because you want that thin profile when we're doing something like thin slicing a hard meat or something.
Yeah, and you know, that part of the ABS testing, I went through some of the ABS training, and for the ABS, it's American Bladesmith Society, for people that don't know. And that's one of the governing organizations that ensures that knife makers are making stuff to a certain standard.
Mm-hmm.
And so they have tests, and they test these knives. And you had to forge, you know, we forged a bunch of knives, and then we would test them. And one of the, so the first, let's get this straight. They would chop through a 2x4. They would cut through like a 1-inch manila rope. And then you had to bend the knife 90 degrees. You'd clamp the knife in a vise. You'd bend it 90 degrees. And it could not break or crack more than a third of the way through the blade, I believe.
Okay.
And, you know, it's funny how many different tests that people use to show the quality of a knife. And then people will take one metric and they'll be like, this is the best knife. Your knife has got to, your knife's got to pop hair. You know, your knife's got to be able to cut through a 2x4. And it's like the test is only as good as the person performing the test and how they use that information. So I bought this best sharpness tester, and it's a scale that measures in grams. And they have different ones, but I bought the highest setting one, which will measure down to the single gram. And it's got a filament that you put on it, and then you take your knife and you cut that filament, and it'll give you a reading.
Yeah, I know you're talking about.
It's got a whole chart, you know.
Yeah.
Razor knife, yada yada yada. There are people out there getting single digits. So just for reference, like I think my Genesis test will test out somewhere around the 120, 130 range, which is sharper than a razor blade, they say.
Yeah. Whatever. Yeah. It's scalpel sharp at that.
Right. But I've seen some guys getting single digits and I'm like, what? You know, I think the best reading I got was 75.
Okay.
Like,
that's
in a legit fair test. Like I'm not trying to cheat. So the deal about that test is you can cheat it.
Okay.
So if you cut really fast, then the scale doesn't have time to register. Or if you have a cheaper quality scale, it won't even measure in the single digits. And the other thing is you can kind of saw with the edge instead of just push cutting.
Yeah.
And so I shipped off a couple knives to the sharpener that's been getting these single digits, and they're on their way back to me now. So I'm going to test them, just see, you know, because I know I don't know what I don't know, right?
Yeah.
If he's doing something – like,
if you want to know, or you want to call bullshit, one way or
the other. And
accolade or bullshit. But,
and I pretty well know that it's the second. You know,
like, yeah, I kind of feel that way myself. Like, there's also a point that if you get to a thin enough terminal edge, well, it's super sharp until you touch something with it, and it won't hold that edge for more than, you know, cutting one piece of paper.
Well, and that's the thing is, like, I sharpen knives in a certain way. Like, so I used to sharpen for like mirror, I'd put a mirror polish on edges. And what I found was a mirror edge is impressive when it cuts, but it's not an edge that's durable for your like everyday use. It's not an edge that it's really not going to perform as well as the working edge that I put on my knife. And so I like a toothier edge. I like something that's going to cut well, and it's going to hold that edge for a really long time. And sometimes that is not going so fine on your grits and sharpening. So irregardless, go back to the testing I'm talking about. Like, this is one test on how it does performs one task.
Yeah.
And it is not indicative of the quality of the knife or of the maker. You know, now certain steels will get sharper than other steels, but it's a level that most people wouldn't even be able to perceive.
Like, yeah. Agreed.
I can get a dollar store knife, you know, shaving sharp, sharper than most people have ever had. And that doesn't mean it's a good knife.
No, and you can do it fast, too. That's the one thing about those knives is the steel's so cheap and so soft.
Yeah.
I don't know how you feel about this. I kind of feel like they are the perfect thing for people to teach themselves how to sharpen with, though. Because if you screw one up, you just throw it away. It doesn't matter. They're a buck or, you know, two or three.
Yeah, when it comes to... I'm thinking about switching up some steels. I'm getting kind of tired of these super steels and just how hard they are to work and how expensive they are. So for example, a great steel is AEBL.
Okay.
And it's a steel that's made for razor knives. So it's going to hold a great edge. It's easy to work. It's relatively cheap. In comparison, it's probably a fifth the cost of like MagnaCut, right?
Okay.
And so at the end of the day, this, like, I've always liked the specialty steels and the high-end steels, but at the end of the day, I would much rather drive around in a Toyota Corolla or a Jetta or something that gets good fuel economy and didn't cost me an arm and a leg, you know? So I guess it's interesting how we kind of go in these, when you start to learn something about a subject, you might get real deep into buying the most expensive, you know, coffee or the most expensive, you know, whatever. And at the end of the day, sometimes that middle of the road is there's a sweet spot there where it's still a really good product, but it doesn't cost you an arm and a leg and it'll get the job done. So, I don't know. It'll be interesting because honestly, I know that my knives are more than most people can afford. And I have to charge what I charge because of the time that's involved in making them, because of the cost of the material.
Sure.
Like I was talking to you before the show, it's like, sure, I can buy $10 handle material, but I buy $40 or $50 handle material. Mm-hmm. Sometimes I buy $400 handle material, you know? And guess what?
Have you ever thought of like making like two versions of this, the MagnaCut and the lower end or something like that, where the consumer can make the choice? Or does that kill you? Because I know when I look at something as simple as doing t-shirts, you know, and if somebody wants an extra small and they want it to be pink and a female cut or whatever, you're like, the inventory just kills you.
Yeah.
So every time you add an option, you add more complexity to everything. And yeah, as a small business, that complexity is not the greatest thing.
Yeah. So for a little while, I had the Genesis. I had the Genesis 1 and the Genesis 2. And originally, I started with XHP, and then the Genesis 2 was N690. And the goal was to get a more affordable version. At the end of the day, I don't remember. It was when you got two knives that are identical.
Yeah.
The only way you can tell the difference is make sure not to get them mixed up before you mark them.
Damn.
You know, it's like, this is a logistical nightmare. But I quit doing the N690. Then the XHB became hard to get, and so I switched to this MagnaCut. But there's a chance that I could change the steel up again on the Genesis. And you know, overall, if I probably made a switch, I'd just probably make a switch. I don't know that I'd carry two different steels in the same knife again.
Gotcha.
I could see changing it up.
I can see that being a problem, too. It's almost like if you want to have a lower cost knife, it should be a little bit different beyond the steel. From a marketing standpoint, as much as an inventory management standpoint.
And I didn't want people like buying, you know, one and trying to sell it as another, you know, like somebody.
Yeah.
And
you're manufacturing your own fake Rolexes if you're not careful, right? They need to be at least stamped in some way that's permanent. What is your advice for people to get started sharpening? I know you are not a fan of any of the easier for you tools, whether it's a little belt sharpener like the Work Sharp or the pull-throughs or anything. I agree, the pull-throughs are crap. I've never seen a good one yet. And I've had people email me, I found one, and you know me, I'll go buy it. You know, if it's especially if it's like $50 or less, I'll go buy it. And yeah, everyone I've ever bought, I'm like, yeah, this is crap. And yeah, I've even had a couple that I've handed to you, and you're like, that's crap. Because I'm like, maybe I'm just retarded and don't know how to do it right. But in the end, like, a good set of stones seems like the way to go for most people. You use a very expensive belt sharpener, but that's because you're making, you know, hundreds of knives out of run. For day-to-day maintenance, it seems like stones are the way to go.
Yeah. So over the years, too, I try to keep separate my personal preference over what's right for maybe Jack or some other person that,
yeah,
you know, because I do like nicer stuff. I do like the King Waterstones and the, some of these Waterstones. I have spent thousands of dollars on sharpening stones and equipment. And, you know, I haven't given that Work Sharp that you have a fair stake. I did want to see about getting that from you and testing it. 'Cause here's the deal. I don't really want to spend the $200 on something.
No, I get it.
It's just going to sit in my, you know, it's just going to sit with all my other sharpening stuff. But I can tell you this, if you don't have the foundations, if you don't have the fundamentals, no machine or gimmick is going to help you, because you really need to understand the basics and the foundations. And I've got an ebook, I've got a digital download, I've got sharpening courses. The School of Traditional Skills came out and they spent a week at my place filming, and they put together a really good course. So any one of those would be good. You can spend the time, you can do all your own research, and you can watch 10,000 hours of YouTube videos, or you can pay a couple bucks, and I have pretty much condensed all of it down to simple, easy to learn fundamentals. And then if you want to top that off, I'm hoping to do some classes here soon. I have somebody interested in coming out to learn sharpening. So if that's something that you want to do in person, hands on, contact me and I'd be more than happy to do what I can. 'Cause this, this person that contacted me here recently was like, look, I've spent all the money, I've got all the tools. You know, I walked through him on the phone, and he's got great stones. And I know that within 30 minutes of sitting there watching him, I can help him. Because sometimes you just got to watch and see what somebody's doing and say, oh, well, there's your problem, you know.
Yeah.
There's the reason I paid thousands of dollars and flew across the United States to learn is because you can learn more from somebody who really knows what they're doing in an hour than you can learn in months on your own. So I'm a firm believer, if you want to learn something, you find the best person that you can get your hands on, and you learn from that person, because you're going to learn more in that short amount of time than it's going to pay dividends.
You're making me think of like when I was learning how to fly fish, my great uncle, and I was, you know, in my teens, I had been fishing since I was, you know, 6 years old on my own. And I was pretty good with a bait caster, a spin caster, whatever. And I was just effing up a fly rod. And he said, just pull all the line in to the leader. Don't worry about any line going out. Put your arm up. And he just grabbed my arm. He said, let your arm go limp. And he just gave me the cadence of it about three times. And then it was like, oh, I got this. It was just that it was so different from what I knew. And I don't think you could ever do that through a screen or in a book or with a picture, because I knew, you know, where it was supposed to come back to, wherever, but there's a certain rhythm in it. And I feel like sharpening is kind of like that too, that there's a lot of people that it's about the angle and they're not holding the angle consistently, would be just one thing, or they're pushing into it, or even if they're doing what you teach, which is pull back, which I learned that from you. I always, until I met you, when I did use stones to sharpen, went on a forward versus a backward pull on the blade. And what you said made a lot of sense. But I could learn to go backwards on your DVD, which is $20 and totally worth it. But to really understand that feel and that touch and have you be able to look at it and say, what you're doing wrong is.
Right.
That's a different thing altogether.
And it's crazy, too, you know, on that journey of learning something. When you start to teach people, which I've been teaching people for many years now, and the more you teach, the more you understand the process for yourself. You know, I'll never forget teaching Sarah how to sharpen a knife. Sarah, for those who don't know, she's part of the community and she's legally blind. And I thought this is going to be fun because she is going to just get it, right? You know, she's going to understand, because sharpening is not just about, it's a total body experience. So you're using the way it sounds, you're using the way it feels, the way it looks. And I can sharpen with my eyes closed because it's more about how the knife feels on the stone, the way it sounds. And I thought she's going to get it, right? And I was teaching her and I got the burr formed and I'm like, here, feel this. And she was feeling it. She's like, I can't feel it. Which when you're teaching somebody, it's very helpful when they're honest with you, because so many people will just say, oh yeah, I feel it. It's like, no, you don't feel it, you know? So she was like, I can't feel the burr. And I was sure that she would be able to feel what I feel, because that's, you know, they say when you lose a sense, the other ones are heightened.
Yeah.
And so then I went into my troubleshooting, you know, obviously if something's not working, you got to start troubleshooting. And I'm like, what's different about her than me?
Yeah.
Why can't she feel this burr? And I realized her hands were dry because she was just watching me sharpen the knife. My hands were wet and supple. So I was like, wait a minute. I'm like, get your hands wet. And so she got her hands wet. She felt that burr. And she's like, oh, okay, now I feel it.
Okay, that's never happening through a video. And it could now, but it had to happen in the real world first for you to even know that would be a thing. Because when would your hands not be wet when you're sharpening?
Right.
They wouldn't be, right? Like,
well, and I mean, if you're learning, you know, some people use stones dry or some people use it with oil. And so it's all, that's what I'm saying. Like when you teach somebody these things that you forget when you learn something, what you don't know. And so being able to get back in that mindset of before, like there's so many things that we just take for granted when we're doing something. There's just like that fly rod, right? Your grandpa, he couldn't put in words necessarily. He's but here, feel this. Like,
well, he tried. I think he just got frustrated. It was my great uncle, but yeah, he got frustrated. He like, just come here. But it was that quick. It was the same, and it probably was for Sarah too. Once you had figured out what the obstruction was and removed it, and then you get that light bulb moment as a teacher, and that's always fun to see a student switch. Like you see their head. Like what you did for me is you made me a knife snob. I have people now that are like, can we send you a knife? I'm like, I don't know if you want to. You know, as soon as I look and it's like a $60 knife, I'm like, I don't. And you know, before I met you, I would have been like, yeah, send it. And I was like, oh, this is a great knife for $60. And I still can look at it that way, but I'm not gonna.
Right.
You know, first thing I'm gonna do is look at the edge, straight at the edge, and be like, oh. Like, I mean, it's that fast. But I don't think I would have cared if I watched a video of you explaining that. It was because we sat down at my table and you showed it to me and you let me feel it and you explained it. Like when you told me put your fingers on it and feel it. And I'm like, yeah, I can feel that sharp. Because you said, do you want to move your fingers? And I'm like, no, hell no, I don't want to move my fingers. And he's like, if you want to move your fingers at all, if you're willing to move your fingers and you're not dumb or numb and you're willing to move your fingers, that knife's not sharp. Yep. It'll cut hair, but it's not sharp. And that changed my perspective completely.
Yeah. When you get used to it, when you get used to a sharp knife, It's always funny to me when somebody's like, well, I haven't sharpened this knife for 6 months and it's still sharp. And I'm like, nope. I'm like,
no.
I haven't sharpened my knife since last week and I'm aggravated that it's not cutting the way that I want it to. And I hand it to, it's a funny thing. I'll always ask somebody's got a knife. I'll say, hey, you know, can I see it? And it's funny whenever they're like, it's sharp, because I pretty much 99% of the time, it is not sharp. It's not what I'd consider sharp. And I was at Trail Days with Jessica and I was sharpening some knives and this guy, he was standing off kind of just watching me. And, you know, he probably was there for 30 minutes or longer. And finally I looked over at him. I said, you got a knife you want me to sharpen? He's like, no, he's like, I'm just watching you. He's like, I sharpen knives for a living. And I'm like, oh, okay.
Yeah.
He's like, I was kind of interested in how your machine works. And I said, well, if you got a knife, I could show you. So he pulls out his knife and I sharpened it and I gave it back to him and he like tests the edge and he's like, well, I don't get them that sharp.
Yeah.
And you know, I don't know. It's just kind of a funny thing. You know, men don't want to admit that they might not be able to do it, you know. Or no.
I can't get it as sharp as you. I can do it. I just don't have the passion for it that you do. Like, once it's utility sharp for me, I'm good. I remember the one time I put some effort into a Cutco, and you came to my house, and I handed it to you, and you touched it. As soon as you touched it, you looked at me, and you said, "Who sharpened it?" And I'm like, "I did." And you're like, "Holy shit." And it's like, yeah, but that took a lot of time, and I'd rather just give somebody like you money and let them do it for me. And I think there's a place for both of those worlds, but I do think everybody should at least be able to get a knife sharp. When I say I can't do what Patrick can do, what I mean is I can totally make a knife sharp enough. It'll shave the hair right off your arm. Patrick can make a sharp, I never saw this till I met him, a knife so sharp that you're holding it above your arm and you're going across the top of the hairs, assuming you're a hairy guy like me, and it'll cut the tips off the hair with the hair having no real resistance. And that was like, holy crap. But I mean, I'm just wondering how many people will ever get to that level, because there's a couple things you have to have. I think there's some natural talent, right? Yeah. There's people like, I'm not going to learn to draw because I can't draw. No matter, I could go to art school for 5 years, I'll be better, I'll still suck. Right. Yeah. So I think there's a certain natural artisanal talent in that. But there's also a dedication to it. And I'm sure it's like a lot of things. I say it takes too long, but if I were to put the effort into it that you did, it would stop taking that long. Because I've seen you pick a knife up and in like 30 seconds, it was dull as shit, and it'll cut hair. Now, it's not where you want it, but you can get it that far that fast.
Well, and this is something, too, that I've realized with knife making and sharpening is when I first started making knives, it took way too long because I was afraid to get really down to the aggressive grits. Like, I would have never, as a beginner, took a 36-grit belt and turned my grinder to 100% and just started hogging away material. Now, that's what I do. I get a 36-grit belt. I turn my grinder up just as high as it'll go, and I'll press into that knife where it's just eating steel.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is you can't mess up when you do that because you're just removing steel so fast. It's like hopping on the interstate and doing 250-mile-an-hour down the road. Most people are going to end up in the ditch.
Yeah.
But the better you get, the faster you can get where you're going, because you know where that limit is. You know where that limit, you start feeling when your tires are losing traction. Maybe you like it when your tires are losing traction and you just keep it at the edge right there. And so, with sharpening, honestly, I hate it. Diamond stones, I hate the way they feel. I hate the way they sound, but diamonds will flat remove some material.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm getting to, there's a diamond stone that I'm going to be reviewing here shortly. Sometimes you might be better teaching a beginner with a little bit coarser of a grit. They're going to have less root. It's going to be less forgiving, but it's going to help them get there quicker.
Okay.
A lot of people fail with sharpening because they're impatient. They try and they start changing things and they give up because it's just taking too long. Mm-hmm. Sharpening takes time to do it right. Now, I could sharpen a knife in a minute, but I've got years of experience. I've got years of practice. You're going to take probably, I could walk somebody through and get them a shaving sharp knife in probably 10 to 30 minutes, you know?
Okay.
But you can't sit there and watch somebody who's a professional and expect to get the same results, because they didn't get those results overnight.
No.
And it is a talent or a skill. It's like playing music. I can learn to play music. I could learn to play guitar. But if you don't have that feel, if you don't have that ear, if it doesn't bring you enjoyment, then why? You know, for me to sit down with some water stones and sharpen a knife, I enjoy it. It's relaxing. It's a great way to relieve stress for the first hour. You know,
yeah.
After that first hour or two, somewhere maybe 3 hours on a good day, now it's becoming work. And now you better be willing to pay me to make me want to keep going, you know. And that's where, like, I know I can't sharpen everybody's knives, but I can teach them. I can teach them to do it for themselves. And then the people who are willing to pay me for my skill, my time, my experience, I'd be more than happy to sharpen their knives because I do enjoy it. Mm-hmm. But I only have so many hours in a day.
Can you kind of talk about what sets knives apart beyond just being sharp? Because one of the things I always tell people, it's great that you bought that knife and it's really sharp, but if you don't learn how to sharpen it, it's only going to be sharp for so long. I don't care what it can be made out of anything. It's still going to get dull and need maintenance. But then there is kind of levels of knives. And I would have said 15 years ago, there's like production and custom. And now I would kind of say there's like production, semi-custom, and custom, more like guns are. Like, I would not call these little Talons a production knife, but I wouldn't call them like some of the other knives you've made for me. I wouldn't put them in the league with those knives that are like a full-on custom. Yeah. So kind of what are the difference in one? I mean, appearance is more a personal attribute, but there's a performance issue there too. And I think the performance issue is more dramatic between like a production knife and at least going to that semi-custom. That semi-custom up seems like performance is very, very similar, but then we get more into appearance and just personalizing and stuff like that.
So there's lots of things that set a production from a custom knife apart. The Genesis, I would consider a production knife, and the Talon. You know, they're laser cut, they're double disc ground, blanchard ground. I put the logos on them. I hand sharpen them. I make sheaths for them. You know, it all comes down to the more equipment that can do the work and the less time I have in it, that makes it, you know, more of a production knife, because otherwise I wouldn't. A custom knife maker could probably make 100 to 200 knives a year. 200 at that point, you about got to be taking some shortcuts and not really spending the time. And then you get into like the really high end custom knives, you're talking about, you're realistically only going to make between maybe 5 or 10 to 50 in a year.
One a week.
Right. Like, and even one a week, you know, like it's crazy how much time you could really put into it. And it really is. It's crazy to think that. So I did the math one time and I figured realistically, I think I shouldn't sell a custom knife for under $1,200. And that seems crazy, but by the time, if I was to pay myself nowadays a living wage, you know, if I'm going to, people don't realize what your hourly rate is not what you're making, you know.
Yeah.
You've got your overhead, you got your insurance, you've got all the cost. And so they hear something even, you know, $60 an hour, and they think, oh, that's crazy. It's like, yeah, well, guess what? If you're an employee and you're making $15 an hour, I can almost bet you money that your employer is billing you at $50, $60 an hour.
Yeah.
End of story. Like, you know, by the time he pays your taxes and your insurance and trains you and all that kind of jazz,
you're in general about 2.25 cost. Is your cost versus what your wage is. On an employee is because it's a lot of things. People, like, anybody's never filed their taxes as a self-employed person or a business owner, you know, they don't tend to be aware. Even if they technically know it, they don't get it. The matching SSI alone, that's like 6.5% right there by itself. And you don't see that money. You see the money they take from you on your check, but you don't realize that exact same amount of money could have been in your check, but your employer paid it. So, yeah. Your cost of labor is something that people vastly overestimate, especially when they make that transition from being an employee to go into like a small business. And they're like, well, I'm going to make 1.5 times more than I was. And well, you're going to have less money.
Right.
I mean, you are. I mean, it's just you need to about double. And then, you know, with the tax advantages you can gain and all, you can kind of break even. You got to more than double to really get ahead.
So back on the your question about custom and semi-custom and all that, it's called fit and finish, how well the handle is attached to the knife, how centered your holes are, how clean your holes are, where your pins are, how even your grinds are, how symmetrical the knife is. There's just so much to fit and finish on a knife that, most of it, when you get into the high-end product or custom knives, most of it your average person is not going to see.
Correct.
And then a lot of it they're going to see after the fact, you know, like Teslas. You know, like, yeah. How many people bought a Tesla and they're like, this car's junk, you know, it's made real cheap and yada, yada. And it's like, can you imagine what a Tesla would cost if they built it out to like a custom standard, you know, leather interiors and, you know, just did it. We are so messed up with our concept of what something should cost from the devaluing of the dollar to labor in China, manufacturing in China. I seen something the other day where this manufacturing company, I don't remember if it was a pen or what it was, but basically we couldn't buy the steel for what China was providing the final product for. And it's hard as a manufacturer to compete with that, you know, like all your Vivor stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, and the hard thing is where everybody's struggling to make ends meet. And it's like, well, I can buy this $500 Vivor sharpener, or I can go buy it from the guy who, you know, developed it, made it, manufactured it, and pay $1,500. And it's like a 3x price difference. And, you know, what are you going to do? Are you going to stand on your morals and, you know, lose your money? And, you know, like, I get it. I understand when people can't buy a knife from me because they can go buy some Chinese, you know, they have the quality on a lot of their stuff. The quality of everything has gone up.
Yeah.
You know, we're talking about the neck knives not have. I'll tell you what, I've looked at, I watch all these new knives coming out. I used to be, my sheaths used to just, you couldn't find anything except for buying a custom sheath. You couldn't find anything that matched with them. I'm looking at the sheaths that are coming with some of these production knives, and man, they've caught up.
They probably got sued by somebody that stabbed themselves in the stomach driving their truck on a dirt road, and that was probably a wake-up call on that, because that was my first thought. Like, they literally gave me that knife, and I might have been going, the new show is not sponsored by Cold Steel. We own them now. It could have been that, you know. And I'm not just crapping on them. They have some cool stuff and some really cheap stuff. But, yeah, I think that part of the improvement in quality is if you don't have quality at all, you can't sell long term. But, two, when you start messing around with things that people can get hurt on, you know, lawyers do serve a purpose, and that's kind of one of them.
Well, and I think, too, the just with the internet and more people finding small makers like myself, I don't see how that couldn't have put a dampener on their parade. And they're like, hey, you know what? People are starting to wise up to what quality is, and we better give them quality because people are willing to pay for it, you know? So I think just like with the sharpening and the more knowledge increases, we're seeing knowledge increase every year. And I think the more knowledge increases, the more demand there is for higher quality, better production type stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. Now, you're also big, though, on the concept of, like, teach a man to fish. So, like you said, you'll sharpen somebody's knives if they'll pay you to do it, but you can only do so much of that.
Yeah.
So, you know, how does that kind of fit into, like, knife maintenance and sharpening and other things as well? Because you're one of those people, you're like, I've never did that before, but it can't be much different than this other thing I did, so I think I can figure it out. And you seem like you've always tried to hand that off to people to have that mindset.
Yeah, like I said earlier, the more skills you have, the less tools that you need. And, you know, with COVID, we saw supply chain issues. And, you know, you talk about preparedness and survival and just, you know, being prepared. When you have a skill, when you have a knowledge, like when you have the knowledge of how things work, it allows you to do things that you couldn't otherwise do. So I sharpen everything. Like, I bought a commercial paper cutter, and I sharpened the blades for it to cut my Kydex. You know, like, and even just cutting the paper, like sharpening it for cutting the paper, it seems dumb, but companies are not going to spend the time to put an edge on anything. Like, knives don't come sharp for the most part.
They,
like,
really don't.
You know, it all comes down to time and money. Nobody's going to take the time and provide you with that. I say that, like, when I send my knives out, they're sharp. But I don't sit here and hand sharpen everyone on a Waterstone. There's just no way. I can do on a machine 98% of what I can do on stones in a fraction of the time. Now, if you want me to put a Waterstone edge on your knife, I would do that. You're going to pay me for it, you know, because my time is valuable. So when you have the ability, when you have the knowledge of how to sharpen something, there's times where it's critical. You know, there's times where it can save you lots of money. So yesterday, they're replacing a culvert down here on my road. And I seen them drive by, and I seen them coming back, and they had they have a big case backhoe. And I stopped them on the way back. I was like, what's going on? I'm like, you guys going to get that culvert replaced today? And he's like, nah. He's like, we can't break through the concrete culvert that's there. We're going to have to get an excavator back here. And I so badly wanted to say, well, you want me to run up on that machine and go do it? You know, because a lot of times, sometimes it can just be the operator, you know. But I told him, like, well, I've got a rock breaker for my skid steer here.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm like, I could run down there and break it for you, break it up, and then you can, you know, whatever. So I ran down the road, and I broke the culvert up so that they could, you know, do the job. I have a backhoe attachment for my skid steer too that I've done things with that shouldn't be really possible. But, you know, so really when it comes down to skill and learning to do something, I saved the county. I don't know how much money, because if they would have had to leave the job, go find some excavator to come out and break the culvert up, you know, like how much money did I save them? They were able to continue working on the job. And sometimes having that knowledge of how to sharpen something is going to help you get the job done. You know, it's going to help you not make a special trip to town because, you know, you broke a drill bit. You don't know how to sharpen one. You know, you just whatever, you know, when you can fix things yourself, when you can work with what you have, it saves you time and money, and it helps you to be able to do things that nobody else can do. Having that basic understanding of what makes a cutting edge sharp, what makes it tough, what angles to sharpen at. So many tools are built for a general purpose. And if you understand that that's just a starting point and that you can create custom edges or angles for whatever you want to do, then it gives you a freedom that you just don't have as a consumer. Drill bits come in all different sizes. You can get drill bits made in any different size. There's a letter chart, there's the metric chart, there's the fractional chart, and then there's customized drill bit. You can have a drill bit made to within a thousandth of an inch of what you want. And those bits are typically more expensive, but sometimes they're just what you need. So a quarter inch pin does not fit in a quarter inch hole.
No.
I learned that making knives.
Yeah.
So every new knife maker's beginning mistake is they buy a quarter inch drill bit and they buy a quarter inch pin and the pins don't fit.
Yeah.
So you can get a quarter inch reamer, and a quarter inch reamer will make that quarter inch hole a quarter inch, you know, exactly a quarter inch.
Yeah.
Well, in manufacturing, you learn about tolerances too. And you don't really need that tight of a tolerance when you're doing something like putting a handle on a knife.
Okay.
Now I like to, but an F bit, I don't remember what an F bit is exactly on the top of my head, but it's like 0.257, maybe 7/7 over. Guess what? You're not going to see 7/7 of a difference on a hole. And it makes life a lot easier when you're not trying to shove a quarter inch hole in a quarter inch pin, in a quarter inch hole.
Mm-hmm.
So when you learn how things work, you can learn how to make them work in situations that otherwise they wouldn't.
Yeah. And there's, you know, as you're saying that, there's certain things that have made my life easier to sharpen, than just use them, and most people don't sharpen them. And like one you mentioned was a chisel, and a dull chisel is all but useless, and they come dull. Like you don't think it's dull until you sharpen it and then you use it and see the difference. Another you mentioned shovels, and that's one thing here, but a hose, like, you know, I started sharpening all the hose that we use in the gardening and the composting, all, and the difference is insane. And it's not the way you sharpen a knife. I mean, we're talking about using a file to do something like that, because you want a kind of a rough, but you want an edge. It needs to be sharp. And I've got hose now that I can use like a dadgone, like a scythe.
Yeah.
Like you can just rake friggin' across and just trim to the ground, you know, weeds and grass. And when you're using it as a hoe, like a grub hoe or something, it really changes everything. Another one, and I learned this in back in, you know, shop class in high school, is something like a plane, right? And you're sitting there with a plane, and it works, but you pull that blade out and put an edge on it, stick it back in there, and that you, instead of planing the end of a board, you feel like you're planing a cake or something. It just flies off of there.
Well, you're never going to make anything of real quality with dull tools.
Yeah.
You know, you can take, if you have a sharp plane, you can make a surface smoother, you know, card scraper, sharpening a card scraper. You can make a surface that's ready to go, you know, save time sanding. So much of having a sharp tool is about making something of quality and saving time and energy. You know, if you're going to go out and use a hoe or an axe or whatever for 30 minutes, you might not really notice much of a difference. But when you go out there and you swing a hoe or an axe for half a day or a day, you really start to see the compounding effect that it has of the extra energy that you're having to put into it and the time. And when it comes to woodworking, you're just simply not going to make quality, anything of quality with a dull tool.
Gotcha.
Because it's going to rip and tear out fibers, and it's going to just leave jagged edges. It's so much more pleasurable using sharp tools.
What about just the role of craftsmanship? I mean, one of the things that I love about your knives is they're like at an artist level. And that craftsmanship carries through a lot of things. I've seen you do a lot of stuff that, like, you wouldn't know that you're not, you know, like a professional woodworker if you look at some of the woodwork you do. And I guess in a way that you are, because sometimes there's wooden handles on a knife. But I'm talking about more like carpentry and stuff like that. Like, craftsmanship is something we've largely lost in society because we have machines that can do everything good enough.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting because there's an aesthetic appearance with everything that, you know, whether it be a car, whether it be a knife, whether it be woodworking. There's proportions and ratios and, you know, the way the curves, and it's amazing how complex a simple knife can be. And it's one thing to make a functioning tool, but I strive to have a level of craftsmanship that people look at it, I guess in some ways, when they look at it and they like it and they don't see all that goes into it, then you kind of done a good job. You know, like,
yeah.
No matter what, if I put five knives out on a table, you're in a convention center or somewhere, people are going to be drawn to one or two of them more than the other three, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's the little nuances in designing the knife. It's amazing what just the little changes can change the aesthetic appearance of it. And even when it comes to using that knife, it may be beautiful on the day it's made, but over time, through sharpening and the profiles change, and it becomes less desirable, you know.
Yeah. So
there's some of my knives that I'm like, I hate to show somebody because it's like, well, when it was new,
it was awesome.
It looked a lot better than this.
Yeah.
Even your handle, you know, like, well, it's a reason they spend all the money on the display cases of diamonds, right? Like,
yeah.
When you look at when you go to a diamond or ring shop or whatever, you're looking at all those diamonds and they sparkle and they glisten and they look so pretty. It's like, put that on your hand and wear it for a week and then look at it. Like, it doesn't look so spectacular when it's not cleaned and polished and
in
the display.
And they have ways of doing it that are like a level that you're not going to have. What the jeweler that I bought a lot of stuff for Dorothy from, when we'd go in, we'd always have him clean like her engagement wedding ring and all that. And he was using like a high pressurized steam to do it. And it was insane. He would hit that thing for a couple seconds and it looked like what was in the display case, but it was only going to stay that way.
Yeah. They got those ultrasonic cleaners. They drop them down in there, get all the nooks and crannies.
Yeah. Yeah. This all kind of hits around self-sufficiency. So for someone that's like getting started on their self-sufficiency journey, what tools and skills would you recommend them prioritizing? Obviously, knives are in that, but it's probably other things too.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that's going to depend on, are they in an apartment in the city or are they on a little homestead out in the country? You know, if you're in an apartment in the city, start learning what you can about, you know, being on a farm in the country, if that's where you want to be. Learning the skills of sharpening, you can make your own knife, you know, go to knifekits.com, get a kit, and make you a knife. All of the things that you learn, knowledge is power. The more you know, the more you can do. The more I love to learn. Be a learner. Be a person that isn't afraid of going out and doing what others are afraid to do. You know, I'll never forget the first time I did a brake job. You know, you get all the people that are like, you're going to change your brakes? Like, that's dangerous. What if you do something wrong? You know, like, it's like, you do realize that the idea of a business, like most businesses, they want the least qualified person that can do the job to do the job.
Because they're the cheapest.
Right. It's like, I think I'm qualified to like figure this out. There's books and there's YouTube. Like there's tons of resources. And guess what? Nobody's going to care as much as you care about how the job is done. You know,
you know, you're just enough younger than me that was a thing for you. Because when I was a teenager and you got your first car, the idea that you would pay somebody to do your brakes wasn't even no one would have done that. Everybody learned how, like, if you just asked around at school, somebody had done brakes on a car that had the kind of brakes your car had. You know, if you like a Monte Carlo had a certain kind of, you know, drum brake in the back or whatever, and it needed a certain thing you needed to know. Somebody knew how to do it. Because honest to God, the cost of having a brake job done was almost as much as the cost of the damn car.
Yeah.
Like, we were out buying $300 and $400 cars, and you aren't going to take a $400 car to a shop and pay somebody $250 to do brakes on it. It wasn't going to happen.
Well, I always hate it when I bought a new vehicle back in the day, because you know what that meant? That meant I had to buy the new Chilton's magazine, and that was $40 or, you know, $30, $40 just so I could know how to work on it when I need to.
Yeah. Yeah.
But, I mean, yeah, I was too, we never had the money to pay anybody to do anything, you know, and I really didn't use credit.
Yeah.
Nowadays, everybody offer you their own financing.
Yeah.
Only 17.9%.
Yeah. Yeah. Variable. No, I drove a car for about 2 weeks before I figured out how to fix it somewhat properly. I had a throttle cable snap right at the pedal, the accelerator pedal, and me and a buddy figured out. We pulled the 6x9 speaker in the back. We pulled the stereo cable off of it. We tied it to the carburetor and left the window cracked and took an old bolt. And basically, when you're driving, you pull back to accelerate. And I drove it for like 2 weeks that way, and I finally figured I could epoxy like a terminal, like that you would solder onto an electronic. Like I could epoxy one of those on the end of the cable that was sticking through. And then I used stainless steel wire, wired it to the accelerator. Not only did it work, when I jumped that car, I wanted to know, well, how hard would I have to push to brake it again? And I ended up taking both my hands and grabbing the steering wheel and using both feet and pushing with everything I had. And it broke the cable, and my epoxy job held. So we used to do stuff like this just because, yeah, you're right, you couldn't afford it. I went to the junkyard to get hoses because a hose was $30, and you go to the junkyard and you get a hose for like $5. You know, you buy two of them, you have a spare one because you know it's going to break.
I just bought bolts the other day for bolting out a grinder.
Yeah. And
I went to the hardware store just to buy it because I didn't have what I wanted. 3/8 bolt, 2 inches long. How much they cost?
I don't know. Yeah. Too much.
Yeah, 75 cents.
A bolt.
For a bolt. No nut, no flat washer. I'm thinking, you know what I'm like, how many people throw away a handful of nuts and bolts? Like, they're toss $5, $10 here. You know, it's just crazy.
Yeah, you say that, but I'm sure that my son will use a lot of cuss words when he's going through all my jars of nuts and bolts that are out in the shop, you know, because I won't throw them away. I inherited that from my granddad. Like, my granddad's generation is about the same as yours. Like, there is no such thing as throwing away a screw, a nut, a bolt, a washer. That's what baby food jars are for, right? Baby food jars and coffee cans for all that stuff. You know?
I wish I still had some of those. You know, you screw the lid to the board, and then you just put the jar up underneath. You can see what you got.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I used to have that all in my garage when I had my first house in Arlington. I had that done because that was what my granddad did.
Yeah.
Took the Gerber lids and screw gunned them up onto the top of the workbench. Why'd I get rid of that? I should bring that back. I just got to find baby food jars now. We don't have little kids no more. What do you got going on in life, though, Pat? Like, you got new stuff coming. You've been doing more YouTube stuff and more podcasts and things like that.
Oh, I just sit around and drink coffee and sleep till noon. And yeah, I don't know. I finally just started making knives again because I'm building a shop, building a homestead, converting a barn into a house, homeschooling kids, making soap again. And yeah, I never know. Like, it's kind of funny because, like I said, I just wing things. I don't really schedule things, but people are like, well, how do you, you know, what do you like? Look, I put out fires. I'm a fireman. Whatever the fire is today, I'm putting it out, and it might be trumped by a bigger fire. Like, so I just do my best. I wake up every day. I work on whatever fire there is today. And some days there's bigger fires than others. And I just do what I can. Like, it's crazy. We've been at this property now almost 2 years, or maybe 2 years. And I'm looking across at a foundation I have started for a shop, and I thought the shop would be further along by now, but it's not. I've got a hoop house that got ripped out by a windstorm 2 months after I put it in, and trying to put out more content on YouTube. I've been trying to just, you know, the truth of the matter is, you know, business, I never really, our life has been kind of a mess the last 4 to 6 years. I never could have factored in how much disruption it would be to move off of our first homestead. And then be in the limbo of not really having a shop to work in. And just, it's so hard to get work done when you're not set up in an efficient manner. And, you know, I went back to work here in 2020 to line work for 7 months or so. And so that was a whole ordeal. And, I don't know. You just got to keep going, keep moving forward. And I'm really trying. I was kind of burnt out, and things have really, I've been reinvigorated to knife making's fun again. I've got over a hundred knives that I'm working on currently. I just dropped the Talon last month. That's been good. I'm far more patient than I was 10 years ago. And I realize that a lot of the things we do, we don't see the fruit for many years to come. And I'm continuing to build this business. I'm thankful for all the support that I've had over the years, and thankful for the customers who've stuck around and haven't said, this guy, you know, whatever. But yeah, I got a lot going on, so much to do.
Awesome, man. And if people want to pick up a knife from you or follow you on social, how can they do that?
mtknives.net. If you would go to my YouTube, if you guys really want to see what I've been putting out, I'm trying to do a live every week where I'll just sit and ramble and maybe sharpen some knives and show you what I'm up to. I had a guy, you know, filming some podcast style interviews and stuff, and that's been kind of fun, but also difficult with the editing and stuff. And I'm not much of the, even before we got on here, like it was telling me I had to switch browsers, and technology is not fun. I don't know how Jack does this every day.
If you do something every day, you get good at it. It doesn't matter what it is. Like, or at least you get competent. You might not get good, but you get competent at it, right? Like, I'm never going to sharpen a knife the way you do because I don't have the experience, and I never will because I'll never do it as much as you have. You know, that's something I'll say, because people say it all the time. I'll go, well, you do these podcasts and you just knock it off. I get people all the time. They want to do my editing for me. And I'm like, it will take me longer to get the files to you than to edit it. And they don't understand. Like, I remember the first time I was on like a big TV show, and I was on like Glenn Beck, and one of his producers is doing the pre-show. They interview you like four times before they let you on. And she finally is looking at my site and everything. She said, who does all this for you? I'm like, I do this myself. And she goes, and you do this every day? I'm like, yeah. She started to get pissed. I could tell she was pissed. You're like, well, what kind of job would I have? You know, just you thinking, it's like, what kind of job would I have if everybody did this, you know? And I'll never have the kind of production value that something like a Glenn Beck show had. But like they couldn't get their head around it. Like one person does the research, the compiling of all the information, booking the guests, all that. Like the only thing I literally don't do at this point is book the guests.
Yeah.
Dorothy does that, you know, and that's a good thing because when somebody's like, I just want to be on the show next week, we can talk to Dorothy and fill it for them.
But now you don't do everything.
Well,
I had to fill out the application.
Well, yeah, you got to fill out your own damn guest form, you know. That's what I'm saying. But
I'm like, Jack, what topic would you prefer to talk about? This, or this? You got to do it yourself.
Fill out the form. Fill out the form. If it's a dumb topic, you get a rejection. At least I'm nice enough to tell you you failed, and you can try again, you know. But there's like that's just putting systems in place into the business instead of like flying by the seat of your pants and putting out fires, Patrick, you know, like having a system in place. The real reason we do that is like, so I got your form here. I've got your website, your YouTube, your Facebook, your Instagram, your Pinterest, all your questions. The time is on here from Dorothy when I'm supposed to call you. You're in my calendar. That way everything happens. Cause what inevitably happened before we did this, I get a guest on and I want to talk about A and they want to talk about B. Like Ron Hood was the first time that ever happened. I talked to Ron back then like every other day, and I'm like, if that can happen with me and Ron, it can happen with anybody. And then the other thing is, you know, you put the show up, and then you get an email. Hey, can you stick my YouTube in there? Yeah. So you put their YouTube in there, and then like 2 days later, hey, can you add my Instagram? Yeah, sure. And then you say, no, I'm not doing it anymore. That's last week. I got to move on. And I would advise people, if you want to make your life more efficient, put systems of efficiency into your life. I wish I could do it at the level that I know is proper, and I can't because I'm a lot more like you than people realize. Like, you've been here, so you know, like, there's shit everywhere and what have you. But there are certain things like guests. I will never have a guest sitting in my StreamYard room going, where is he? Like, is he showing up? And like 30 minutes late, I'm flaked out. Like, because I'm bad at stuff like that. So anything that, like, you're bad at, that's where you most need to systemize. Yeah. The thing that you're most likely to flake on or say, screw it, I'm not going to do it today. Like, if you hate it, or something's going to die if you don't do it, or you're going to go out of business if you don't do it first. Like, that's one of my ways that I try to keep organized. Anyway, it's been a cool conversation. Good to catch up with you. Are you going to be at Nicole's 2 months from now, I guess it is?
You know, that's probably the funniest question I get from you or Nicole. Are you going to be there?
Yeah.
It's like, listen, I'm dependable in that. Like, I'm basically going to be there until you tell me not to show up. So, yeah, I'm going to be there.
Okay.
I'm looking forward to it. I'm actually speaking. I would have to, because I'm so organized, I'd have to look at my notes and tell her what topic I'd
what it is.
Pull out of my backside. I've definitely tried to become more disciplined and scheduled and routine. And it is – There is a certain level that you have to be successful, and that's definitely an area that I have to work on. But
well, folks, if you want to meet Patrick and you never have had the pleasure, I think there's a few tickets left to Living Free in Tennessee, which is in April sometime, like you. I don't really know. I've got my airline reservations, so it doesn't matter now. They'll tell me a day before to go get on the plane, and I will. But I'm going to be up there, too, and you can come hang out with us and you can watch Patrick sharpen knives and cut himself. It'll be great. So come on out and join us, Patrick. Thanks for being with us today.
Yeah, thank you, Jack. Yeah, and if you want any hands-on instruction at those events, I have time to sit down with you and really help you one-on-one. So take advantage of that.
Definitely. All right, man. Well, we'll catch you next time. I think we got an expert segment coming on for you tomorrow, too. And there's the blade. The real blade. That's not a knife. That's a knife. All right, Patrick. Thanks for being with us today.
Take care. Look forward to seeing you.
All right, man. All right, folks. I hope you enjoyed that. Definitely come out and hang out with me and Patrick and Nicole and a bunch of other really great people. And if you come to any of these events, man, make sure you do take time to network. It's not just about showing up and having some presentations and stuff. The networking is a big, huge part of the value. On that, I want to let you guys know, for my workshop coming up this fall, this is the first time this is being said publicly beyond a very small circle. For the first time ever, it's not going to be at my place. We have a new venue, and it's going to be really cool, and there'll be more details coming about it. And it's only about 25 minutes from my house. Nicole was just here and we went and checked it out and we both agreed it's kind of an upgrade. But the upshot of that is this year, instead of selling 50 tickets, it's going to be more like I can do about 85. We'll have the space for people. I don't know that I want to grow much beyond that, because that close networking experience is something I don't want to give up. It'll probably be the same week it always is. We already have that locked on the calendar with the venue people, and we'll tell you more about the venue probably next week. We're way out from that, but I did want to let y'all know that. Because so many people do come to that workshop to hang out with people like Patrick. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and wrap things up. Let me remind you, if you like the show and the work that we do, you can always help support us just by doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com. That is T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. And today's item today, same one as yesterday, the AeroPress coffee maker. I'm so impressed with this thing. I'm not allowed to use anything else in our house anymore. Dorothy has determined that when I make coffee, I have to use the AeroPress. She said that from when she had her first cup. French press is kind of retired now, except for making tea and stuff like that. These things are awesome. And I'll tell you what I really love about the rich, deep flavor of the coffee, because you're using more of like an espresso grind with it, which you just can't do in a French press because you end up with blow by like crazy. There's no residue in the cup whatsoever. But the big thing is cleanup. It takes literally 15 seconds when you're done, press the press all the way out to clean it, because everything's in this little compact puck at the end. So they're great for travel as well, especially you guys are on the road a lot. Hotel coffee tends to suck. Take this thing with you. As long as you can make water hot, you can make coffee with it. And you do all kinds of stuff with it. You can, you know, read the instructions and decide how foofy you want to get, but you can do like cafe Americanos, espresso styles, et cetera, lattes, all the foofy food crap so many of you spend so much of your damn money at Starbucks and what have you. You could be making it at home and put all that money back in your pocket. Also consider becoming a member of the support brigade. If you do that, you get discounts and tons of stuff. Your membership will pay for itself. And with that, we'll wrap up. Tomorrow, we're going to have an expert counsel Q&A show for the week. I think I have a segment in the bank from Patrick for that. And we'll wrap that show up, and then we'll do a Friday flashback. We'll come to it all over again on the next week. Take care, guys. I'll catch you on the next episode.
They said you should have a house the American way. A dollar down, a dollar a month, and you never have to pay. There's a better way. Let me show you a better way.